What? Yeah. So everybody, is this working?
It's not.
No, we can all hear you.
Yeah. How about? Okay. So everybody, thanks for coming to Rubicon.
Yeah.
This is it. This is all you get.
And, yeah, you can go home after the speech.
Yeah.
Four, I don't care.
Or buy the shirts though.
Either way. But yeah, Rubicon 2001. So I guess it's our third year, and you know, yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
you can
don't
you
feel
can
bad to applaud. Don't be afraid to applaud us.
You can applaud wildly, sure.
Yeah.
It's
not really good on the tape that way.
Yeah.
I guess we are recording all this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So all this stuff should be available on the website afterwards, I believe.
Oh, hey, you never told me you were gonna record it.
Yeah. Well.
Okay, we won't record your. Okay, we won't record Forno's. All right, everyone. So this like won't be recorded.
Yes, that means that Jim is going to be able to put comments about how Forno was the only speaker that allowed us to record him.
On the other hand, Jim's creativity. So,
what's this about Amanda?
Oh yeah. All right. So like, you guys think it's hard putting on a computer conference. I'm sure you're well aware of all the trials and pitfalls that we must endure. Well, let me tell you about Amanda. all right, so like, as some of you may realize, she was supposed to give a speech on artificial intelligence this afternoon, and this still bothers me so much. But I'm gonna bitch about it. Why not? So like, she found out that her ex-boyfriend was gonna be here, a certain John Erickson, and so she decided that she was too upset to attend. And so instead of coming to the conference and giving her speech, she was at home crying and being a woman.
Hey,
oh!
Misogyny unite! Are we recording?
Yeah, that was all Jim's comment there.
Yeah.
I've already got Nick screaming, I'm a fucking vandal.
Yeah,
clips of the Rubicon core group will be available. CDs are only $12.
I'll rate them by the most incriminating.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't need to hear that.
Yeah, so that's the sort of stuff I have to deal with.
Well, yeah. So I guess, like, everyone, don't break anything.
Yeah, don't set the hotel on fire.
And if you could, like, avoid stealing things and,
Yeah.
I guess it's okay to put cigarettes out on the floor as long as it's not this one.
Yeah. apparently the entire hotel is a smoking room, so it should be all good.
And if you do decide to drink tonight, you know, drink responsibly. And the hotel has informed us that they're a little, they want to sell you the liquor. They don't want us to bring our own, mostly because they're charging like $5.25 for a mixed drink. I can't imagine why. But so if you do, you know, I'm not encouraging or suggesting anything, but just try to keep it like in something that they can't tell what it is.
You know? And of course, if anybody's looking for a liquor store and you go out the main doors. go to your left, like around the corner, and there's a little store right there.
Yeah, so back to the Rubicon Professional Conference.
Anyway, yeah.
Before I muck this up too much.
Turn it over, of course.
Yeah, I think we can hand it over to our keynote now.
I don't know. Are there any? Does anybody have any questions or comments that they would like to yell out?
I mean, feel free. Like, we suck, so.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We need a motto or a song or something.
Rubicon, like, hack this bitch Detroit style.
Yeah.
Yeah, you raised your hand, so therefore you have to say something.
I was just wondering what kind of liquor store
it's on. It's Michigan, so everything closes around 2.
Yeah, they can't sell
Yeah.
Oh, I like this.
The clubs, the one club over there is open till 3, but they don't sell liquor after.
City
Club's
open till 4.
No, not City Club. City Club's open till 4?
Yeah, but they stopped selling liquor at 2.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They stopped selling liquor at 1:15.
So, now, you don't get to say anything about your laptops.
I got 4 laptops.
Hey, don't listen to him. Bleep this out. So I guess somebody's selling laptops.
Yeah, apparently somebody's selling laptops.
Do you have a license for that?
No, but you get AOL for free.
So
and AOL's not an operating system?
I don't know, there's got to be some witty Rubicon stories.
Some what?
Some witty Rubicon stories.
What are you doing?
Phone room, but like, we can't say anything about that. Okay, so...
All
right. I guess, like, wait a minute. I guess we're still messing around with this projector, so we should probably ad-lib a little bit more.
Bust some rhymes out from the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, bust out with your mad freestyle, yo.
Yeah, you would like to DJ?
No.
Oh.
Scavenger hunt.
Yeah. Oh.
If we're massing stuff already, will you come by the room to check
The way the scavenger hunt works, to my knowledge, is we have closing ceremonies, and you have to physically bring everything down here.
Yeah.
So that means, like, my car.
Like, even though my car is on the list, you have to somehow get it into the ballroom and, like.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, we will accept the ballroom, except for the items that are already in the ballroom, which we have no knowledge of.
We got Leatherman.
Yeah.
I think the car works the same way as a dollar. So as long as it's more than 50%, it's still valid.
Yeah.
That's the way American currency works, right? I don't see any reason to change the system. By mass. So I think the engine, it's a neon. I mean, I can't imagine anything.
Hey, go ahead and tell them the license plate number too.
Oh yeah, it's a red neon. It's got some side damage to the passenger side. The mirror's all cracked up. You could fix it for him, too. I bet you'd let you win if you fix it.
No problem. Yeah.
I'll probably give you a free T-shirt.
Yeah.
It
smells like pizzas, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder why.
So, Nick, is all the setup?
Huh? Yeah, it's good to go.
Oh, well, you might want to remove the lens cap.
Yeah, of course.
Don't miss Luna FF's T-shirt.
Woo! Really?
Yeah, and you'll get to see Nick naked.
Yeah, which I'm showing up for.
Right now, nobody's going to show up.
No, hey, we'll be here. Incriminating evidence. But Nick was a stripper too. So
just that one time for gas money.
So do we have teams for Win Out Another's T-shirts yet, or are we?
I thought it was just a last minute thing.
Actually, it's basically if you want to play in the trivia game, just show up at 1 a.m. And if demand exceeds available spots, I'm just going to start taking bribes like Dark Tangent does at DEF CON.
Cool.
Yeah, so feel free to give me money and props. Yeah, you know, I don't like working. Yeah, you know, a job is nothing but work, and it's not any fun.
Speaking of jobs, anyone who can get me a job doing user interface security in San Francisco will instantly win NFF's T-shirts.
Okay.
I'm not kidding.
Okay, so before this boils down to us selling ourselves, I think we better hand it over to Mr. Forno.
Yeah. Let's do this as well. For our opening, well, not quite opening, technically, like, not, our keynote address this year is being handled by the incredible Rick Forno, who is seated to my right. Oh, where is he? If you find him, he's got the thing now.
Just saying nasty things about him until he appears.
I'm just going to read his blurb here.
That should be good.
Because.
Have you heard enough pamphlets?
Yeah, I can only assume that nobody out there is literate, so we're going to do this way. Yes. Rick Forno, currently consulting and writing on information security topics after leaving the Internic as chief security officer from 1998 to 2001. Before that, he helped establish the Information Security Office for the U.S. House of Representatives and was a consultant to the elements of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he assisted in researching and developing capabilities needed to respond to information warfare attacks against the United States. Mr. Forno is a frequent speaker at security and intelligence community seminars and industry conferences. His 1998 co-authored book, The Art of Information Warfare, and numerous articles have been hailed by the government, the military, and the private sector. And you should buy his book. He is a co-author of an O'Reilly book on computer incident handling due out in fall of 2001. He will be presenting building... yeah. He's going to be doing a speech titled, Has Anyone Learned Anything? A Synopsis of the Information Revolution Thus Far. And I'm sure it will be fascinating and interesting. Informative, yeah. So anyway, without further ado, a big round of applause for Rick Forno.
What a motley crew of people. My God. Well, thanks, Jim. I told Jim I would do this. He invited me to speak last year, and like 2 days prior to Rubicon last year, I pulled out. Work had me going a couple different ways, and I couldn't make it, so I felt really, really bad. So it took a lot of guts to type up a little, Jim, sorry to tell you, but Detroit's going to have to wait for a year. But he took it in good spirit, and apparently last year went off rather well. Missed some of the fun, but so be it. The topic of the keynote tonight is going to be a little bit different. I'm kind of notorious for jumping off the tangent a little bit. And basically it's going to be called hyper-reality, the real dangers of today's technology, or as I like to call it, are we becoming techno-slaves? Okay. And it'll be a little fun dynamic session going over here. And at the end of the presentation, we'll have a little Q&A discussion going. And I will be giving away a couple of copies of my book. So don't leave, or if you leave, you'll lose out on the chance. And hopefully we'll have some fun. Before we start, I said... before we start, as Jim said, you know, I have done some work with the government. I am not a spook. I am not a Fed. I have never arrested people. That's a good thing. I have many friends who do. I've helped them out. And when it came to the point of turning in some friends or having my sanity, I said, forget it. My friends are more important. So therefore, I said, federal law enforcement is not my life. So that's it. So just so you know. Before we start, I'd like to take a quick second, and you all know about the news. Like I said, I am prior military. I would like to take a minute and just take a moment of silence, think about the guys over in China. Hopefully they'll be let out real soon, but I would do my part to our country if I didn't, at least say a little something about it. So let's hope they come home real soon. You heard about my biography, and basically I just want to know, are there any feds in the room? Any feds? Any media? Media. FBI? Maybe? Anybody want to admit they were FBI? Family? Well, local police, I don't care. I'm from D.C., so, local police, come on in. I don't care. Okay, let's see. Rigel 5, glad you got a Mac. I got some here as well, so you're in good company. And as time goes on, by the end of this presentation, you're going to realize that the Matrix from the movie, the idea, the premise, is actually here and alive in our society today. First off, I'm going to start with a little bit of FUD. For those of you who don't know, FUD is fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And this came from a book written by the former U.S. National Security Advisor, Anthony Lake. In his book, Six Nightmares, he says basically, are you under 30? If so, chances are you've got enough technical know-how to be a cyber threat. And if you don't, he says, you can find everything you need, including cyber attack tools and their instruction manuals, guess where? On the Internet. Armed with these tools, he goes on to say, millions of computer-savvy individuals could wreak havoc against the United States. Wow. I'm afraid. You didn't read this, did you? Okay, skip that part. He already... Okay.
I'm sorry.
Bottom line is, that doesn't scare me, and I don't think it scares many people in this room. The only folks that scares are those people that hear about it on the nightly news at the dinner table. The Cold War is over. There are no nuclear missiles pointed at us from the Soviet Union. So the next big thing to get everybody all scared about something is cyber terrorism, cyber warfare, hackers, crackers, whoever. But that's not all. FUD, FUD, FUD everywhere. This past week, the Pew Charitable Trust Internet Project came out with a survey. And these are a couple of statistics just to kind of set the stage for where we're going tonight. And I agree with a lot of these, but I just want to, segue into this a little bit. Of the, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 people surveyed and that responded back, 92% responded back that kiddie porn, and 87% said that credit card theft were the top two concerns. I have no problem with that. My credit card actually was stolen a couple of years ago in the Real Names incident. Kiddie porn, I don't think many of us, hopefully we don't have a problem with the kiddie porn issue. 78% say the U.S. government's sites being hijacked and hacked is a bad thing. Someone paints a mustache on the Attorney General's face, that's a bad thing. I didn't go to DOJ.gov and, fantasize that Janet Reno's, portrait there, so mustache wouldn't really appeal to me, but whatever. 82%, a whopping 82% are concerned over internet terrorism. Okay. 56% think it's okay for carnivore. Now, my question is, and I don't know how the question was worded in the survey, but basically the idea was, do you think it's okay for carnivore to intercept criminals' email? And the people, 56%, said, yeah, sure. Well, my question is, how does the sniffer know good email from bad email? What does the sniffer do? Sucks everything, right? You be the judge. 70% of concern over destructive viruses. My advice, get off of Microsoft. 84% are concerned over family privacy issues, and that's where I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about later on, personal and privacy issues. But in reality, what the survey says and what the activity of the government and the private sector have been in the past couple of years has been basically, we have problems, but you know, don't rock the boat. Technology's cool. We're here to stay. You know, all of us MCSEs have job security, and you know, we'll go on and have a great and prosperous life. Well, those, I don't think, were the real threats or the dangers or the vulnerabilities or the exploits that we're facing as a wired society. The real ones are the ones people don't want to talk about. And I was going to jump into this point and go into a Jack Nicholson thing and say, because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want these things. But no. Bottom line is that people don't want to talk about a lot of what really is at risk here. So the dangers of being a techno-slave, as I said earlier, are come out of a couple of key areas. Intellectual property, anti-consumer products and services, PKI in the security industry is currently implemented, and then I'm going to discuss some issues with federal law enforcement, military information warfare, and then bring it to a closure with basically a reality check and figure out, you know, where exactly we are. Okay? What it comes down to is that this is a security conference. You're going to have a lot of lectures tomorrow and Sunday on various elements of security and you know, computer, you know, not so much hacking, but security and, you know, the computer underground. So I want this to be a kind of a kickoff, kind of scratch your head and think, you know, yeah, there's something here to it. And keep that in mind as you hear the sessions over the weekend. What it comes down to is personal security in the age of information and invasive corporate interests. That's where I'm going to be going with this tonight. First up, intellectual property concerns. And I'm not going to beat a lot of dead horses, but Napster and DCSS. Who here's in high school or recently graduated? Do you have to read Fahrenheit 451?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the summary? Somebody give me a quick two-sentence summary of what Fahrenheit 451 was about. Come on, somebody, hands.
Censorship.
Censorship. Keep going, somebody else. Back there. Burning books, yes. Books were basically the resource, right? That was the technology people used in the book to exchange information. It's an idea. It's not an idea. Books are not an idea, okay? DVD is not an idea. DVD is a medium in which information, i.e. entertainment, is used to be exchanged. So like Fahrenheit 451, you have a problem here with, in this case, the industry coming out and saying, look, this technology is a problem, when in fact it's really an idea. I'll talk about Napster first, then DCSS. Actually, vice versa. DCSS, as we've all followed, 2600 is leading the charge against the current brouhaha with that. But it shows the corporate monopoly of DVD players and computer operating systems. What spurned the DCSS issue? A bunch of us Linux folks said, gee whiz, I want to play DVDs on my homebrew computer that I built for $500. There are no players out there for it. I can pay $3,000 to get a nice Wintel box and my player's built in. Well, that's a problem. I want to do it right now. So Norwegian codes it, releases it, boom, Hollywood goes ballistic. And we have the lawsuits to follow. Well, after about 2 years of this, my consensus is that Hollywood's lost the war. And I'll be a little political here and say that DVD, DCSS and Napster, this idea of peer-to-peer sharing of information, it's a lot like capitalism versus communism and democracy. It's the idea. You may be able to silence the movement or silence one or two leaders hither and yon, but the movement and the idea will continue. And the idea of having an operating system exclude a popular operating system excluded from being able to enjoy the riches, if you will, of the digital entertainment industry means that, you know, there's going to be people always nipping at the heels of big business to say, I want it. You know, we're going to keep hacking DCSS until we have, you know, drivers coded for us. Hollywood's lost the war. Napster, for the most part, it's there. It's got filters in place. I've been on it in the past couple of weeks, and I've gotten some files downloaded, but it's not nowhere near as robust as what it was, 6 months ago. And we expected that. So Napster was a scapegoat for the music industry. So Napster goes down. Well, I'm sorry to say, Hillary, that there are others in the wings. You've got everything from GNUtella to Windows file sharing to FTP. Are they going to outlaw FTP? Should they? On Monday. Or maybe an MPAA version of the FTP demon?
Yeah.
You know, personally signed off on by, you know, by Jack Valeni. You know, I don't know. Monday, I was in France last week at a peer-to-peer conference. I came back and I was trying to, you know, get over jet lag with a, you know, Starbucks in one hand and a beer in the other hand, hoping that would help. And I'm sitting there watching TV, and I'm watching C-SPAN. I mean, I used to work on the Hill, so, you know, C-SPAN every now and then has some good stuff on it. I mean, I used to work there, you know. Anyway, they were doing online entertainment and copyright protection hearings. Oh, gee, that perked my attention up because I was in New York at H2K when Lars Ulrich was testifying on Napster back in last July. So this was like a natural follow-on. Bottom line is that industry's in trouble. And the great thing about this hearing was that for the first time, you had artists involved in the hearings. Ted Nugent couldn't make it. Alanis Morissette filled in. Don Henley. They had Hillary Rosen from the RIA and some other folks there. And for the first time, you started hearing people saying that, gee whiz, I'm an artist, I'm a musician, and we're getting screwed by the industry. You never heard that before on the Hill. It was always the industry was losing money. And now you had a bunch of artists saying, wait a minute, we want to get our work out there and not be stifled by business interests. It was very interesting. So what it highlighted on Monday was that there's now disparity. Thank you. A little flash confusion going on there. Disparity between now the artists and the industry, where previously people figured it was just the industry against the pirates. Intellectual property also has another interesting twist, and that is that you have providers are consolidating. You have limited choices in what you can see, watch, or do, and there are serious cross-branding issues.
Propaganda.
VeriSign merger network solutions. You have DSL providers having consolidation, and by the way, you can't get DSL or broadband everywhere. So therefore, those in the outlying areas, maybe even here for all I know, you're lost to take advantage of these high-tech, high-bandwidth technologies coming down the pipe. AOL Time Warner, that scares me on several levels. What that really means is that big business has and will continue to drive legislation and standards, particularly in this area that's infusing and affecting our daily lives. I mean, Boeing is America's biggest commercial aircraft company. They make the 747 and all these other little planes. Great. That's fine. You know, I fly an aircraft. I don't care what it is, as long as it gets me where I got to go and get there safely. But I do get concerned when I'm told what I have to watch, when I want to watch it, how I can watch it, and what I can do with what I've already paid for the rights to watch. That concerns me. Moving on to the MPAA, and this is not a personal attack, but Jack Valeni. He made a very good point Monday in the hearings, and I actually applaud him for how he started off. Of course, what followed totally undermined everything he said 5 minutes earlier, but he started off on a high point. He said that the entertainment industry, be it, you know, publishing, books, records, DVDs, movies, whatever, is America's greatest economic asset and greatest trade export item we export overseas. I agree with that. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. I mean, it's more than Hollywood generates more money for the country than the wheat export does. Okay, and there's a lot of wheat going out of this country. That's wheat, not weed.
We import wheat, not export wheat.
I think you import wheat, but anyway. The entertainment industry gives great job growth. Okay, it's a fantastic revenue leader. People have great jobs, job security. I mean, it's a wonderful industry to work in. Then he goes on to say that this industry, for all of its glory, must not be subject to the Sherman Act. High school guys, civics, U.S. civics, what's the Sherman Act? You raise your hand, you got to say something. Sherman Act.
American schools.
Public schools. Antitrust. It's partly what Microsoft was found being attacked a couple of months back. Okay. Basically, Valeni says we need to continue to operate as we have been and strengthen our position as a monopoly because, you know, we bring so much goodness to the country. And it's funny that he said this now on the Hill in light of the economy where the Dow and the NASDAQ go up and down 300-400 points a day and people are skittish. So that was a neat little spin on how he portrayed the problem. Put it in money terms in a very rocky financial market and people just say, oh, my God, you know, he's right. So then he goes on to continue, and this is where he started losing me. And they're saying Hollywood is going to be distributing videos on the net, you know, releases only on the net or concurrently on the net, and they do it in theaters, and this, you know, it's great. But the problem is not bandwidth, you know, the limitations of broadband, or the size of these files, which we all know are huge, especially if you have, like, you know, a 128 ISDN line or something like that. But he says, and I quote, The net is populated by thieves, criminals, punk kids with no respect for decent behavior.
Woo!
And as a result, Hollywood's very reluctant to start releasing things on the net. Wow. That's, how different is that from me going to Blockbuster and getting a videotape and then copying it for 20 of my friends? Exactly. Or removing the magnetic strip and pocketing. I mean, there are very simple ways. What's missing, of course, the Blockbuster analogy is that, you know, you can put it up on a hard drive and you use Hotline or anything else and just download it over the web. Okay, so you have global distribution. Valenti then says, okay, I need to go show you how easy it is. And this is in front of Orrin Hatch and Senator Leahy, two very respected senators who actually understand technology. They're actually our friends on the Hill. I mean, they actually get it. So Valenti gets up, and Jack's like 79, 80 years old. He's all excited. He goes over and he says, I want to show you how these thieves, criminals, and punk kids with no respect for decent behavior can download our content, our product. And he goes over and he pops up a still of a Gladiator. He says, this is still in movie theaters, and it was an Academy Award winner, and we're and this has been downloaded via, in this case, he actually did it off of Napster. And he says, we downloaded this, via Napster, he says. And over the net to show you. And he shows a 32-second clip, and he made it very emphatic, 32 seconds. Well, first off, they were in the middle of a congressional hearing room. He didn't download it in the hearing room. So you don't get the feel for, if you're on a slower link, chug, 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 as things download, nor do you get to see exactly how it works or how difficult it may be to search for a given file, okay? So when the committee was not impressed, they said basically, well, this is on your hard disk. You didn't download it. Basically, your little demo didn't impress us. Villani turns around and says, well, I'm technologically illiterate. This is the same guy who is, pointing the finger at, the computer underground saying, we're all punks and, ne'er-do-wells. So my question to Mr. Valenti is, do all computers, like DVD players, have to be MPAA compliant? Otherwise, we'll all be in violation of the DMCA? I don't know. Now, I'm going to do a shameless plagiarism from George Carlin, one of my favorite comedians. And I was going to clean this up, but I guess I'll do it the way he said it, just because, well, what the heck. And he says that America's leading industry is quite simple this. It is the packaging and marketing of premium, high-quality, all-American, top-choice, grade-A bullshit. He says the best marketers are a lot of the big companies and, to a lesser extent, the U.S. government. And he goes on to say that if you don't believe this, consider this, and this I actually like, and if you're still in school, take notes, this actually will help you somewhere in the project. He says, the founding fathers, this country was founded by people who were white, unelected, land-holding, slave-holding men who decreed all men are created equal, except for African Americans, Indians, and women, and then decreed that their class is the only one allowed to vote. He then goes on to compare Bill Clinton and Bob Dole's election in 96. And he says, Bob Dole, and he says, Americans like, being told up front, we're not stupid. And he says, Bob Dole basically says, I'm a plain and simple man. And the American people said basically, bullshit. Bill Clinton says, hey, folks, I'm completely full of shit. And they said, well, at least he's honest. He got reelected. Take that analogy, move it into big business. We're hurting. These punk kids are stealing from us. Bullshit. Moving on to the DMCA, for those of you who don't know, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and I'm going to discuss two pieces of legislation in relationship to intellectual property. I just kind of did a little capsule about entertainment industry. I want to talk about DMCA as a piece of legislation, as a single hallmark that is tied to the entertainment industry. DMCA, and this is a very abbreviated summary, makes it a crime to circumvent anti-piracy measures, DCSS, allegedly. It outlaws the manufacture, sale, or distribution of code-cracking devices used to illegally copy software. DCSS, allegedly. It does permit things to be ripped apart for security reviews. Okay, that's good. We can actually, make sure that the security things are indeed secure. It limits ISPs from copyright infringement liability, big bucks in lawsuits, for simply transmitting information over the Internet. So people who are had DCSS up on the webpage. If you know the ISP was called, they were expected to take it down. They would not be held liable if they didn't. ISPs, however, are expected to remove material from websites that appear to constitute copyright infringement. Well, DMCA came to notoriety about a year and a half ago when Microsoft was releasing specifications for Windows 2000's implementation of Kerberos. For those of you who don't know, Slashdot. Anybody does not know what Slashdot is? Okay. For those of you who are newbies, Slashdot is probably one of the premier online chat techno-policy rant, rave, bitch, whine, and moan boards on the internet. Very popular. And any website that's referenced in a Slashdot article, people who read Slashdot then go to the website, and the website that is referenced goes under because all these people are going to it. It's called the Slashdot effect or a legitimate denial of service. Anyway, in this case, a Slashdot user, an anonymous coward was his name, posted the Microsoft Kerberos specification as applies to Windows 2000. Now, Microsoft over the past maybe 2 to 3 years has made it a point to become publicly much more open source. Bullshit. That came from down there, by the way. Well, this character posted the Kerberos specification on Slashdot. Microsoft, in turn, hires their big gun lawyers to go after Slashdot, saying, excuse me, this is proprietary information, this is security stuff, this is posting it is in violation of the end-user agreement that this specification was released under. Well, for those of you who don't remember how the story went, they released the specification as a PDF file, an Adobe Acrobat file. They released it with inside an installer, you know, Windows-based install shield type of thing. Well, it wasn't too difficult to basically open the archive, the installer archive, and drag the file out to the desktop, and then just double-click the file and read it. You never saw the license agreement. Microsoft went ballistic. They said, well, this is in violation. I said, look, you know, basically, you were stupid. You should have known better before you released it. A lot of Slashdot commentary about it, basically, the issue kind of died. I mean, nothing really significant happened from it. But just to show you the lunacy of some of the stuff involved, vendor released something that was, you know, poorly packaged, and then they try to litigate their way into compliance. Okay, the Hollywood industry, instead of trying to extend their embrace, if you their will, to include the Linux community and the open source community, they said, forget it, we're only going to go with the established players, and therefore you're on your own. And that caused people to be creative and the lawsuits that have ensued. That's one piece of legislation, which, by the way, is still in controversial discussion on the Hill as to how much is going to be overturned. Which brings us to the great circle of computing. Back 30 years ago, in the early days of computing, well, of modern computing, if you wanted to log on to a computer, you had a little blue or black screen, green characters, a little VT100 terminal. But there, I think that there's some in the other room. And I think they were giving them away for doorstops or boat anchors. But anyway, you would log into the network or the mainframe via the dumb terminal. In fact, my first internet account was off of an IBM mainframe through a dumb terminal. And I mean, it was dumb. And that kind of moved away into the PCs in the late 70s. You had mini computers that got smaller and could be housed not in a data center but in an office. And then you had the desktop computers that gave people the ability to store files and their applications on the desktop. Didn't have to talk to a central mainframe for all that stuff unless they wanted to. And the file server, the centralized thing, became a resource. And then the race for desktop computing power grew, and everyone became enamored with the PC to use various sundry things, and the PC proliferated, and it's everywhere. So, now we are in, what, April of 2001. We're going back to the centralized mainframe days. We're going back where we're moving towards an application service provider and a mainframe where basically all your data, applications, all your data now belongs to us. Or all your data, what is it? All your data belong to whatever it is. You know. All your basis one was, you know, figure it out. Anyway. Meanwhile, while we're going back to this model, PCs are still coming out with DVD burners, CD burners, CD drives, DVD drives, and we're getting, you know, gigahertz boxes and all this other great stuff on the desktop. But now the desktop's basically coming to a dumb client. We're coming full circle. The goal is to have a lot of the applications and information stored up somewhere else. The PC becomes an appliance. That's what Larry Ellison at Oracle was trying to do a couple of years back, and it flopped. So now we're going to be paying $3,000 or more for a high-powered appliance that really has power to do things, but the software that's on it can't, unless you're running Linux or BSD. So if you look at computers, like Network Solutions, we had a call center, a huge call center, and I won't take NSI ribbing just yet. But we had a call center, and people had all these great computers, the $10 an hour temporary employees that would be hired to do, first-level, second-level support. They had, Micron and Dell machines, decked out. $2,500, $3,000 gets you a pretty good computer a year or two ago, right? Well, before they were deployed the computers, they removed the CD drives, the zip drives, the floppy drives, didn't take the speakers out, used Tivoli and other tools to lock the box down, so basically all the employee could do was what the four or five things on the screen would say. Couldn't configure or do anything. Couldn't play a CD, couldn't do anything. So for a $2,000 computer, $2,500 computer, you basically were left with a $1,000 network appliance. Now, I'm not an MBA student, but that doesn't make good business sense to me. If you're going to be using computers as a dumb terminal, get dumb terminals. Go raid an old 386 shop somewhere and throw Linux on the box or BSD, throw it in there, and you got your applications right there. Why pay for what you're not using? Anyway, so now we've come full circle back to the centralized mainframe days where all your data belongs on a centralized server. And you may know where I'm going with this, but the most widely known software deployed is also the company that's proclaiming this to be the next great coming of computers, which is we're now coming back to a Redmond-controlled ASP. Now, this is a company that's not known for security or in their software or network reliability. Their security advisories are come in my desk as much as spam does from, Viagra dealers. There's a new one or two or three every week. They should pay me to read them, actually. And it's the same company that wants, all your data to be on their server farms, but yet they failed DNS and networking 101. They parked all four of their DNS servers on the same piece of wire, and when the router goes down, everything went down, from Passport to Bill Gates' private network. Now, this is the same service, Passport, that's going to become the trusted identity on the Internet for us in this server-based model. I'm a little concerned, but we must go on. People do not read the fine print. Like lemmings, and, of course, the average American, I'm not talking about us in the room, we actually have a clue about technology, computers, and big business. We read Slashdot. And we use fresh meat, but whatever. Like lemmings, the average Joe and Jane six-pack are going to rush out to buy the next greatest thing, Windows XP. These are the same people who probably had ancestors in ancient Greece who said, oh, what a lovely horse. I'll sign for it and bring it into the living room. Why does this scare me? Well, let's see. The circle of computing comes back from whence we began. We've now got what? In security terms, a single point of what? Of failure. Gee, that sounds very Microsofty, doesn't it? Ugh. Single point of failure means that you are in serious risk of having your data compromised, stolen, whatever, taken away. Privacy, you don't have any positive control over your data or applications. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm a security professional. My job is to be paranoid. As a high-tech citizen, a netizen, I'm scared. I'm terrified. So this brings up the idea of trust. Since you don't have positive control over your internet identity, your applications, your data, and your single logon for all the other future things you might want to do while online, you've got serious privacy concerns. And if you look at the Passport homepage, there's like 50 or 60 major companies that are using Passport technology as their single sign-on gateway. If you have a Passport account, you can buy a book at Amazon. You can cash a check at American Express. You can go to flowers.com. One-stop shop for everything, including one-stop shop for your information. This is under the aegis of what the industry is calling subscriptionware. You pay us for the privilege of using our software, which actually is the way software has always been. I mean, you never really own the software. You bought it. You bought the license to use it forever. But in this new circle of computing world, when we're back at the centralized server idea, the consumer, the end user, we are guilty until presumed guiltier. Our livelihood, our productivity, our identity in cyberspace, and unfortunately, because of the pervasiveness of technology, and even in the real world is affected by this, our livelihood and our well-being is at the mercy of the corporations. And when I was in school and I was reading William Gibson and, you know, heard cyberpunk and this great stuff, I'm thinking, yeah, okay, whatever, great science fiction reading. But as we're moving on, I mean, I'm starting to really get concerned because we're kind of coming to have science fiction as a great predictor of reality. You see the software companies under subscription where it's actually kind of interesting because you pay in advance, like a magazine subscription. Anybody ever try to cancel a magazine subscription? How many people got it right in the first try? You still got 3 or 4 months worth of it, whatever you got, right? So the vendors get a little complacent. You pay in advance, so they have your money. They're collecting interest off of your hard-earned money that you've given them. Now let's say there's a problem or there's a noted discrepancy. You're at their mercy as to when and how they decide to fix it. You're stuck in their system. And in the case of something like the Whistler Windows XP, you know, that's more than just like, you know, if Outlook Express, you know, or dies, you know, you reinstall it and you go on. This is something much different because it encompasses your entire, everything in your cyber identity here on the, in your computer. This complacency kind of scares me. And I've seen this at other internet companies and, you know, firsthand. So, I mean, I'm not just, you know, blowing smoke. This actually does occur. Not to be outdone, the Redmond factor. Visual Basic, in my opinion, is the harbinger of all evil. Its integration into every application on the desktop, both corporate and consumer, presents significant security problems. The desktops on both platforms in the corporation and the enterprise are built to include and incorporate Red Bundled or Tide, the Internet Explorer. Why do I need to use a web browser to change my printer settings? Add a new user? You got to do it through IE. You view a file, your file list, you see it as a web page. That's the default setting. Even when you turn that default setting off, you still have a quasi-web browsing view, and it looks like crap. But it's there. That's what we're being force-fed. A year ago, there was a great vulnerability from Microsoft, which really kind of blew me away. And that was not the BO2K issue. You know, CDC says, well, you know, you say BO doesn't work in NT. Well, BO2K does, but that was kind of humorous in itself. But an advisory came out, and I don't have the advisory number, that said Microsoft Office clip art can be exploited to take over your computer remotely. Clip art? My little picture of Donald Duck beating a computer is going to compromise my data security? My God. So that brings us back to the centralized computing. I'm trying to highlight the security issues associated with the company that's poised and marketing themselves to be this Uber keeper of our internet identities and information. So, as I mentioned DMCA with regards to the entertainment industry, let's talk about a piece of legislation, not legislation, but it's a law that's being passed by the various states, a particular subset of this law. This is called UCEDA, Uniform Commercial Information, whatever it is. I forget the acronym. It's UCEDA. Look it up. Section 2B. I strongly encourage anybody who gives a hoot about their future in computers to read it. The abbreviated summary. Software is as is with no warranties. Okay, we've seen that before. I mean, that's been the licensing verbiage from day one. It also says that if the license is included as a README file as part of the install process, and it says that by opening the shrink wrap on the package, you agree to abide by the license and you haven't read the license yet, that's okay. So you're being blindly bound into something you have not even seen yet, but now you're a party to. It says the publisher of the software is not liable for defects or viruses in the program, even if they are known by the publisher before it's released. What if they sold cars that way? Well, the Ford Explorer, I don't know, but I drive one, so I can say that. The third one, publisher is not liable for any damages whatsoever, including incidental and consequential damages, which include calls made to customer support lines, which may be more costly than the software itself. $200 900 number calls to Redmond to resolve a problem. That's very common these days. Four, consumer remedy is limited to replacement of the software or a partial refund, whichever the vendor decides is appropriate. The publisher may dictate the form for any action taken against it, meaning that if you have a problem and you want to pursue this and say, look, you know, Company X, I don't agree with you, you have to go to them. So if you're a poor college student or, a single-income family or whatever, and the company registers their holdings, let's say, in Delaware or Guam, then you have to go to Guam or to Delaware or cross country or to Bellevue to take this issue to court, to the local court in which the company is housed. So that sheer expense right there is going to turn a lot of people off from pursuing activity. Finally, all personal information you provide in the registration process may be used for any purpose by the vendor. That's included in UCD2B. Yes? The second to last bullet. The publisher of the software may dictate the form for any action you as a user might take against it, meaning you have to go to them. So if I set up a software company, and let's say you're in Washington, D.C., I set up a software company in California. If you want to take me to court because you lost data or time or money trying to resolve a problem, you got a virus on my software product, okay, you can't just do it in D.C. court. You got to fly out or trek out to California and sue me in the court wherever I'm headquartered. Now, that's some of the high points, the rather sane points of UCD2B. There's another little thing that is probably the most poignant issue involved with UCD2B, and that's called vendor self-help. Show of hands, who's heard about this? A few. Okay. What this basically says, and if you aren't shaking in your boots by the time I finish this slide, you're really going to, you're either stone, drunk, or just asleep, and you just, get out now. It basically says in UCD2B that publishers can have 15-day time bombs in their software. So, for example, let's say you purchase a copy of Windows AB, and you buy it, you license it for the first year, you pay $100 for your first year, and you get it, and then your invoice comes and says, okay, it's time to renew. If you don't renew, your software can be remotely disabled by Microsoft or whoever. And your data is held hostage. Not just, data for like Microsoft Word, let's say, but your computer in general. Okay? Now it gets better. This invoice or this notice they send you as the end user consumer may be sent by email. And the fact that it was sent is the only indication or the only, approval the company needs to take further action against you. Meaning, I send you an email. I assume he got it. And then, I got a response back. I shut his machine down. He never got the email because maybe he went to like a hostmaster address and is sitting in the spam queue. Okay? According to UCD2B, that's legitimate and the vendor's in the right and you can't do a darn thing about it. It also made a little point about a year and a half ago. PC Magazine was trying to run a comparison survey with some enterprise database access or Oracle. And anyway, long story short was they had a poll of the review. And they also did a review of the latest version of McAfee antivirus for enterprise. McAfee cited UCD2B in the following way. Review our software license before you write or decide to publish the review. So PC Week went to, they reinstalled the software. They looked at the little, thing everybody clicks through. They actually read it line by line. And it said in there, the customer shall not disclose the results of any benchmark test to any third party without network associates' prior written approval. Further, the customer will not publish reviews of the product without prior consent from network associates. This was in their software license agreement. Suffice to say, PC Week did not run the review. Okay. Moving on, that's being a security tool. What does that say about full disclosure for security vulnerabilities? A year ago, there was one of the exploits of Microsoft's IIS was reported by Loft, when it was Loft. Loft published their advisory and, recommended solutions and whatnot, as best they could. They sent their advisory and supporting documentation to Microsoft, said this is a big problem, y'all really want to address it. Microsoft sat on it for a couple of weeks. Result of that was that Microsoft ultimately came out with a patch but like a month or two after the Loft reported it to them. Okay. Comes down to the full disclosure. Meanwhile, BugTrack, and you know, they were screaming, you know, talking all about it, this type of stuff. But again, we talk about complacency. You know, we have an install base out there. We'll decide what to fix where and when. Also, about that same time, Microsoft changed how they issued security advisories. When you get a security advisory from Microsoft up until about 3-4 months ago, you got the full discussion of the exploit. This is what's wrong. Here's what it affects. Here's what you should look for. Here's how you fix it. Here's where to go for help. Here's whatever. And then the 2 pages of legal text that follows saying they're not responsible for any damages you might incur by doing the fix in the first place. Now you basically get a 1.5-page email that says there's a security problem with product X. Here's what it entails briefly. Visit the website for more information. What that really does is it does two things. It more tightly controls who gets the security information, because you can't just get the old advisory and forward it to all your friends. Well, you can, but then they got to go to Microsoft to get the website, to get the full technical discussion. But what it also does is it gives Microsoft the upper hand, because now they can decide what they want to promote in terms of the advisory technical information, and they force you to go to their website. So there's a little bit of marketing involved. Who's actually reading our advisories? How effective are they? What are people looking for in the advisories? I mean, not like the old days, okay? Another little problem. So to close out the IP section, intellectual property, there's an issue with fair use of music and software. You see, I mentioned earlier about people are guilty until proven guiltier. You have copy controls built into the DVD players, hardware and software, and the software ones can be cracked. I mean, I've got a region-free DVD player right here, okay? HGTV is not taking off, partially because the cable companies are slow in, you know, coming online, but also the entertainment industry is scared because there's no copy controls built into the digital TV boxes in the houses, meaning that you can record wherever you want off HGTV in the clear, and Hollywood's scared they're going to lose money through what else? Punk kids pirating. If you look at TiVo or the digital video recorders, okay, you'll notice a couple things missing from them, most notably an ability to record out. Okay, you can't export what you have on that hard disk out to another machine, and there are also chips built in there that will take advantage of whatever, like SDMI comes along for HGTV. Okay. The software, we talk about Windows and Whistler. When you do the activation key for registrations for Whistler, if you reinstall that, you can't just go take the CD and reinstall it on another computer. Let's go back a little bit. In the old days, you bought a piece of software, brought it home from the store, pop it in the machine, install it, run it, put the box on your shelf. Oh, my God, I trashed the machine, pull out the box, go reinstall it, whatever. About 5 years ago, the vendors started complaining that, you know, there's software piracy. So now instead of getting a blank CD for Windows NT or 98, you got one that was tied to the BIOS of your Dell box or your Sony box, whatever, and you could only install it on a Sony or Dell box. Also at the time, too, is a funny thing. They actually would set up partitions on a hard drive and put the Windows install files there and not even ship you a CD. Well, now my question is, what if you trash the boot sector of the hard drive? How do you get at that particular partition?
You get a nasty virus.
You get a nasty virus, you know, your host. What do? You got to go out and pay $100 for a brand-new retail piece of software. Now you're at the point where they're going to be taking this software online, where if I have Windows XP loaded here and then I trash this computer, I have to actually pick up the phone and call Microsoft, say, hello, this is Rick Forno, I'm here in Detroit, I trashed my computer for whatever reason, here's my user ID, here's my registration number, may I please have an activation key to reinstall the product that I got 3 months ago? If I decide to swap out a hard drive or my video card or whatever else here, change the BIOS fingerprint, it sort of invalidates the authentication. Well, Microsoft, they'll say, well, gee, are you using this on the same computer or are you selling it to your friend or giving it to your friend? They're trying to clamp down on where their software is going. A couple of dangers with Microsoft XP, Windows XP, .NET, and Hailstorm. I mentioned privacy concerns. We'll talk about privacy in a little bit. Your data is held hostage. Whistler is being touted, or XP is being touted, as the digital media platform. It's got Windows Media Player that has full advantage of SDMI, all these straight copy controls, so that basically you download an e-book, you can only read the book on that one computer. You download an MP3, a new MP3 file, can only be played on that one computer. You can't copy it. There's even some work called Secure Audio Path that will allegedly, keyword allegedly, prohibit you from copying MP3 files. My theory is unless your speakers are compliant with the rest of your computer, once the data leaves the sound card out port, what you do with it is up to you. But they're trying to get end-to-end soup-to-nut control over your data content, be it MP3s, DVD videos, or in some cases, your operating system. You see where this is going in terms of we're becoming technologically slaves bound to the big business corporate interests. Bottom line for intellectual property is that, and this is the soundbite, so all you media folks out there, consumers are guilty until proven guiltier by the unelected captains of industry, not legitimate courts of law. Think about it. Moving on, security, my little fun favorite part. Anybody here use digital certificates? PGP or VeriSign or, you know, Entrust? Okay, cool, a few. I want to tell you right now that the industry, the PKI industry, is flawed. It's broke. It don't work. They're marketing a lemon. Two key problems, and I'm quoting this from an article that I wrote about a week or 10 days ago that's already been reviewed by a couple of big crypto folks on the net, and they love it. I've got a couple of requests to reprint it. And basically it says PKI, a matter of trusting trust, and why the current PKI industry is built on a house of cards. There are two key problems with PKI. Now, PKI, for those of you who don't know, is public key infrastructure. Public key encryption, the idea being that it's supposed to be a great level of trust and confirming without a doubt that I'm who I am and you are who you are. No matter where we are on the net, we can always confirm that through a third party. Okay? That's the five-word version of what PKI is. Two problems with PKI is the industry has currently implemented them. By the industry, I'm saying, you know, the VeriSigns, the Entrust, the Thought, and those companies. I'm not talking about the free stuff like PGP in its free form. I'll talk about that in a second. Two problems, authentication for generation and authentication for confirmation. Authentication for generation. VeriSign, about 2 weeks ago, made public that they actually issued two Class 3 certificates to people allegedly from Microsoft. For those of you who don't know, Class 3 certs by VeriSign are the equivalent of a government background check. You know, they actually read documentation, have to corroborate from a couple of different sources, and do some due diligence before they issue these, you know, highest level of security certificates. Unlike a Class 1, which are really disposable, and anybody can just go out and get one for, like, you know, $10 or something. As a result of this breaking, by the way, this happened in the end of January, and it didn't break into the media until about 2 weeks ago. We're talking about, you know, the time delay here. What this points is a couple of things. First off, for the people who have paid VeriSign or and whoever for real certificates on their websites, after the fact that these two certs were made out in public, two questions come up. One, how many other certificates are floating around that were erroneously issued? I would say fraudulently issued. And two, what value does that place on those certificates that people are paying good money for? And three, what's more valuable right now, the certificates that Microsoft or Apple or whoever is paying, you know, 20, 30, 50 grand a year for to sign their software, or those two that are floating around and were issued for a couple of weeks before they were picked up? What's more valuable? How valuable are the legitimate certs owned by the big companies legitimately? They're worthless right now, and I'll tell you why. You can't verify them as an end user. You can't easily click in your browser and say, gee, is this cert from Microsoft actually a legitimate cert that signed my code or that's securing my transaction? You can't do that easily. It's not easy to do. And if you look on the website at VeriSign, you got to dig around for their certificate revocation list, which is like a giant bad checklist, if you will, you know, at the five and dime store. When you find it, there's no FAQ. It's basically a giant text file saying, read me, we're not responsible for what you see, and then here's like 10 files, go through and find it. Not very helpful. Regarding authentication for generation, the PKI industry places a heck of a lot of emphasis on securing the key generation process. Gates, guards, guns, two people. It's like launching a nuclear missile out of a silo. I mean, there's a process that has to be followed, and it's airtight. That's wonderful. Well, gee, someone's able to social engineer their way through that process, so it's not allegedly as airtight as people think it is. And two, the PKI of companies require for these large certificates, you know, these major corporate certificates, notarized documents proving, you know, your identity. Anybody here know what a notary does? They sign the dotted line. What else do they do?
They verify that what you provide to them is what you've written down.
What I've provided the notary is what...
I give you a document, you're a notary, you'll look at the document, you'll look at my description of what that document is or the copy of it, mm-hmm. you will put your stamp that says, yes, this is the copy of it.
So that would mean that a notary public has to be an expert in everything known to man, because if you say, you know, if you give me a document about your family history, I need to know about it.
Pretty much, no, he's just saying, no, that's the document you're describing here. The document has this name on it, and it says this is what it is. And
wrong. Wrong. Notary publics do not verify the content of the documents. They will only validate and verify the signature on the document is indeed the person sitting in front of them. And by the way, how when you go to a notary public, the only information they say is, you have a driver's license? There are no cameras here. How many folks have fake driver's licenses? I made it when I was young. I mean, I had some, you know, there are a few. Or fake ID of some sort. There, more hands. Okay. Knowing that, you can go into a notary and get stuff notarized and probably get your own certificate. As long as your signature matches up and the picture on the little ID card matches what you're presenting to them and who you are, you'll be able to get through. That's allegedly secure. We're staking our PKI trust for large companies on a fake ID that I could do off an inkjet printer for $20. That's a problem. They're placing trust in the wrong places. The other problem with PKI is that there's authentication for generation problems. You can bypass the authenticating the user and the applicant for the key, and therefore you can get certs issued erroneously. There's also a problem with authenticating, or what I call authentication for confirmation, meaning the certs are out there. How do you verify them down the road? 3 months, 6 months, whenever. I say use a credit card model. Security is not just a one-sided fire-and-forget solution. I mean, it's an interactive process that's ongoing. So just because you have a cert doesn't mean that I should automatically trust that cert is valid. I should have some sort of due diligence on my part to confirm that you are who you say you are, like a credit card company. You go to the bar out front, I know many of you will, have been, and will be going again. I'll be out there later. And you can buy me a drink. You can take your credit card, give it to the bartender. He'll swipe it. It'll call Visa, say, you know, hey, you know, $20 for Forno's booze. Well, they'll look at this and say, all right, what does Visa do? Credit card, and some of you can probably tell me this better than I can, but bear with me. A couple of things happen. First off, Visa says, oh, the bank who issues the card says, all right, is this request coming from a legitimate terminal? It's not just, you know, a plug-in somewhere. It's actually coming from, you know, a little blue box that we know about. If it is, okay, great. What's the amount? Is that amount within the available credit limit on this card? Does the card number, is it a valid card number? Is the card number valid and is it active, i.e. not on a blacklist or something like that? If it is, the process is approved and you get your drink and, you know, we're all happy. PKI is nothing like that. It's a very one-sided solution. You buy a certificate, put a little stamp on your website. Hi, we got a VeriSign certificate. We're secure. Trust us. I can't confirm your trust. All I can do is believe you by saying that, yes, we're secure. It's like putting, you know, the good housekeeping seal of approval. Another problem with certificates, these alleged guardians of Internet identity and authentication, is that they don't expire. Look at your web browser. You'll see certificates there from certificate authorities expire in 2020. 2030, 2050. And these are not just single certificates. Basically, any cert signed by Company X is therefore now approved through 2020, 2030, 2050. My driver's license expires every 6 years, my passport every 10. And those are legitimate government documents that confirm my identity and authenticate me as a U.S. citizen. Is there a problem with this in the PKI world? I think so. If you look at the VeriSign webpage, and this is not a slam at my previous employer, by the way, this is a problem with most of the PKI vendors. It just so happened that VeriSign was involved with this latest incident that I just had to write about. If you look at the VeriSign website, you'll see that PKI is positioned more as a marketing tool to verify the authenticity of people visiting websites and less as a security tool. That's kind of weird. I thought PKI was supposed to guarantee my security and my accountability and my authenticity. But you look at the white papers, the first two bullets are marketing driven. So that you can, by using certificates for your little shopping club, you can verify who's who, what's what, do tailor marketing based on geographic region, by user preferences, by history, so on and so forth. And you know that I'm who I say I am, and therefore I get certain preferences. That's a problem. A couple of simple countermeasures that I proposed to the industry in the article is going beyond just simple, you know, believe, trust me, we're a valid certificate. Verify MAC address. I'm requesting a certificate on behalf of Microsoft Corporation. Well, when I request it electronically, VeriSign or Entrust or whoever knows that the IP address is coming from the network that Aaron reports as being owned by Microsoft, that the MAC address of the computer requesting the certificate is coming from a MAC address that is on the database with VeriSign, very similar to like an access control list on a router. Is it foolproof? No. But security is never foolproof. It keeps good people honest, and it makes it hard enough for the bad guy to say screw it and move on to an easier target. The idea is to basically make it more difficult for this sort of thing to happen in the future. Robust authentication in the key generation process. That way the certificate authority, the VeriSign, knows that the certificate request is coming from a legitimate source in their role as a certificate authority for Microsoft. Also, people think that they use certificates for a web commerce transaction, Amazon, for example, and that means your entire transaction is secure. Fire and forget. It's not. People forget that all certificate does and SSL does is guarantee the point-to-point security that you can't have yourself intercepted over the vast wasteland of the Internet by all of us cyberpunks and criminals and kids out there. However, look at what happens on the back end. How many companies, and I've spoken to several CTOs and CEOs of security companies who have done audits of large e-commerce firms, once payment information comes to the web server, the back end is passed unencrypted, is stored unencrypted, and there is no way to verify that the server that that information is going to is indeed the server that it was intended to. You've heard about man-in-the-middle and spoofing attacks? How hard would it be for somebody with the right resources to go in and stand up a fake payment server somewhere if they had the insider knowledge to maybe add in a little line on the internal DNS of a company? How many credit card numbers would you need to get from, let's say, an Amazon or an eBay to, you know, to make out like a bandit? 5 minutes worth? 25 minutes worth? As long as the IP address is in DNS and it's pinging, obviously it's going to respond. The knock won't say anything for a while. When you see business slip, there might be a, you know, an investigation, but by that point, you'd be long gone. So PKI is marketed. It's not a silver bullet. It's part of a total security solution. You have other modes of authentication. Use it with TCP wrappers. Verify end-to-end security behind your firewall, not just over the Internet. Okay. Verify who's requesting key generations and modifications. There's more to it than just simple buy a certificate, go on. Okay, law enforcement. Anybody here a law enforcement? No law enforcement folks here. No hands?
No hands of law enforcement people anyways.
Any 1811s here? No. Anybody want to admit they're 1811? All right. NIPSI. This is going into now another issue, the third point of my presentation. That's on basically the U.S. government's response to computer crime, computer security. NIPSI, National Infrastructure Protection Center. Is it effective? Is it or is it not? Anybody know what NIPSI is? NIPSI is the National Infrastructure Protection Center. It was stood up 2 years ago under Bill Clinton's administration. It is an organization housed at the FBI that is the central point of critical infrastructure protection investigations. But what it really comes down to is they're the cyber cops. 90% of what NIPSI does is they're the focal point for computer security attacks and, you know, industry calling, we've been hacked, you know, come help us. They have a national security role for, you know, cyber terror, but they also have a bigger role in terms of helping industry do investigations. Having been on the inside of industry for a couple of years and seeing NIPSI stand up and getting calls every couple of months to come join them, which I refuse, I don't think it's effective. Why do I say that? Because their successes are too public. They only catch and publicize two types of people. Web vandals, okay? You have this large organization in the FBI whose press releases read like a who's who in web vandals and graffiti artists. And they go after the denial of service guys, the Amazon, the eBay, those incidents. NIPSI is located in the FBI, which means that by nature it's part of the FBI, which means it's subject to the FBI's bureaucracy, mindset, groupthink that goes back to J. Edgar Hoover's days of wearing short skirts, high heels, and pantyhose for all their agents and a nice little hat. The FBI, every time they would call me, when I was working at the Internet at Network Solutions, they would say, you've got a network intrusion. A domain got hijacked, you got a network intrusion. Amazon.com got hijacked. I'm thinking, wait a minute. I'm sitting here on top of my network. I'm looking at the network diagram here. I know my network. You're telling me you know it better than I do? Why is this a network intrusion? Just because something's wrong with the computer means it's a network intrusion? Well, I came to the conclusion after getting several of these calls that the way Microsoft says that all they do is innovate and they produce great software is like that's their mantra. Like, we do great software, The FBI's version is, everyone's got a network intrusion, that's all we deal with, And that's all I got. They don't, and the FBI, NIPSI, you know, as an organization, they don't play well with others. And I don't mean to say that in a negative sense because there are some very talented people in the FBI that I've worked with, some good friends of mine, even at NIPSI. But as a whole, they're caught up in this groupthink of the FBI that they're arrogant, they don't play well with others, they know it all. They know it all. I told Jim this last, I don't know, who was I driving home with last night? Simon. Last night, about this little incident we had. I got a call from the FBI field office of West Virginia about 2 years ago when I was at the NIC. Guy called me and says, we have these six domain names and a couple of IP addresses we're trying to learn information about. I said, okay, great. You know, we can help you out. What do you want? So here are the domain names. He gives them to me. And, you know, I just passed them on to our lawyers. And he says, well, now these IP addresses, what can we do with these IPs? I said, what do you want to do with them? And says, well, you're the Internet, your network solutions. Aren't you the keeper and assigner of all IP addresses? This is coming from a computer crime squad.
How long ago?
2 years ago. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, I mean, as much as I dislike the Bureau, I'll play along because, you know, I am industry. I mean, I do have more of a clue than they do. I'll help them. I mean, that's part of what I was paid to do at NSI. So I say, well, that's not really what we do. We do domain names. I mean, but you might want to give Aaron a call. And the response was, Aaron who? Does he work for you? I didn't want to ask him if he thought NS Lookup was a Mrs. Lookup, but I didn't want to go that route. But I'm thinking to myself, this is what we're dealing with in terms of our Internet investigations? So that was 2 years ago. Let's segue forward to September of last year. We had a couple of big viruses last year, and we had the one that came out of the Philippines. What the heck was the I love you with the Filipino, right?
Yeah.
That came out earlier last year. September of last year, I come into work and I do my usual morning run through the knock. And they're in a panic. We heard on the news this morning that there's a new virus, we got a problem here. So I said, okay, fine. They're all saying the FBI has discovered this new virus. So I go to the NIPSI webpage. Sure enough, there's a press release up there. Press release said one thing. This is September 1st, 2000, one line. A new virus has been discovered from the Philippines.
All right.
That was it. Imagine a CERT advisory saying, a new virus has been detected in the Philippines. First thing I thought was, Jesus, do I have my immunizations? Am I safe? So, I had to laugh. So I picked up the phone. I called the FBI, the watch office, and said, you guys got to be kidding me. I said, I'm a security professional. What is this? You're trying to pull here. I mean, you guys are laughing stock. I said, well, we had several of the guys say that, there's a problem. We wanted to, put more information, but the PR guys said, no, get it out there now, so we're first to market with it. Now I'm thinking the FBI is going, first to market at... Now... Does this sound like the software industry? First to market at 20% reliability as opposed to last to market at 100% reliability. This is going back to the we know it all part. Well, we'll let you know more. So I called and I'm thinking, there's an op-ed in here somewhere. I go back to my desk, thank God it was a quiet morning. I started writing that in an article. This is just too good to pass up. Well, about 2 hours later, they updated their website. Now they say, well, here it is, and it's basically a Word macrovirus and a little paragraph. Okay, they cut and paste from Melissa, or I love you. Okay, fine. But the idea is that they know it all. And when they come on site, it's like, well, we're from the FBI. And although they've softened up a bit, when they go to a lot of these technology companies, they still report and say, we're from the FBI. They all show up. They still show up wearing suits and ties. I've been to conferences. You go to DEF CON, you go to Black Hat, you go to, Rubicon. And there are people from NSA wearing what? Jeans and an NSA golf shirt saying, yo, what's up? Let's go have a beer. You will never, ever Yes, I do watch wrestling. Catch an FBI person in jeans and a golf shirt saying FBI. Or we say, come have a beer with us. That's not the way they work. They have to be the professional striped suits person a la J. Edgar Hoover days. That turns a lot of us techies off, okay? Because that same attitude means that, okay, you know, that's how you approach things. In the box, you know, you approach things very narrow focus. Well, as a security guy, you know, as hackers, as, you know, whatever we're doing in the computer underground, we don't think in the box. We wouldn't be here. We don't think out of the box. We'd be considered rebels and cyberpunks. We bring our own boxes along, okay? Every time you see the FBI investigating a computer crime on news, you see them like the San Diego field office or San Francisco field office, and you walk down the hallway and there are, you know, these federal investigators typing away at the computers and all. Stripes are pressed, you know, tie clips and studs and all. And I'm thinking, that's not how you go after a bad guy. I mean, I took this out of an article I wrote about a couple of years ago, but basically I said, you want to catch a bad guy, a legitimate, you know, criminal, call it, you know, a kiddie porn person or whatever. You don't go after them with stripes, you know, put out an APB to all the field offices and say, be on the lookout for a kiddie porn age, you know, 24 to 60. You don't throw bodies at the problem. What you do is you park one federal agent in a room to be the go-between to the judge to get the warrants and get whatever information they need. You park half a dozen hackers in the good sense, the white hats or whatever, folks who actually have a clue about technology and how can do things effectively and not get caught. Let them do their work. Give them Jolt Cola, give them pizza, and just, you know, put up with the techno for 6 hours, and you'll get results. They'll say, go to the judge with this, get this, you'll have your guy in 12 hours. But they don't work that way, okay? They think in the box, and that shows in how their investigations work, okay? That's how they deal with the industry. They're very in the box, very, very straightforward. And even their InfraGuard program, which is their alleged public-private partnership, is very – it's still – you don't get a warm, fuzzy feeling in dealing with them. It's still, you know, we're the FBI. You know, we have a lot, but we're not going to tell you. You know, anybody here listen to Bill Cosby comedy? Okay. There's a great skit he does called Noah. And he's like, Noah in the Ark. You know, Noah, ding, you know, build me an ark. Well, Noah, and there's one line that's really funny. You know, the guy says, well, the ark is built. He's waiting for the flood. And Noah's neighbor comes walking outside. He's like, you know, looks up at Noah. He's building the ark. And he's like, you know, this guy's going to work. It's like, Noah, hey, up there. He's like, you know, what are you doing? It's an ark. Okay, what's it for? I can't tell you. That is the epitome of how the private sector has been dealt with by the Bureau. It's, we know stuff, but we can't tell you because, A, you're not cleared, and B, you're not an insider, and C, you don't wear striped pants and a tie. That's a problem. Industry works great amongst ourselves, okay? I've been in many a meeting with people, with other fellow security folks at companies. We go out and have a couple of beers, talk, share information. It's wonderful. But then you have these meetings where the Bureau's involved and industry shuts up because they know that whatever they give them is going to be absorbed in this black hole. And whatever they get back from the Bureau is going to be so well cleaned up and sanitized and so well out of date, it's useless. I mean, I've been in some InfraGuard meetings where basically the feedback from the FBI was somebody somewhere at some time is going to attack you. Gee, thanks. Moving on, law enforcement. There's a little quiet thing heard about in Europe called the Council of Europe Treaty on Cybercrime. This is a neat little under-the-radar way of getting international rights and law enforcement powers in computer crime. And it stands a little discussion. One of the key points, which is kind of funny, is that they say it'll be illegal to traffic in basically hacker tools. Or the exact wording is like tools that can be used to compromise a computer. So that will basically mean ISS, Accent, Symantec will be out of visual. Microsoft will be going out of business. I mean, okay, that Traceroute. I mean, you know, Telnet, exactly. Okay, that was written. That was, I'll buy you the drink. That's the one. That was. They softened the wording up a bit for the last iteration, and I forget what the exact wording is, but that shows you the lunacy that law enforcement is trying to deal to get a grip on this. The other part that actually stayed in there, and is basically still being figured out by the Justice Department how to address it, is that a crime committed under French law by an American citizen in this country means that France will call the FBI. The FBI can then immediately go to your house, detain, arrest, seize information, computers, equipment, on behalf of the French government. That's an under-the-radar way of getting significantly enhanced law enforcement powers from about 20 or 30 countries. And I can talk more about that offline because I've done some reading into it, and you know, that's very frightening in my opinion because it really means that goofy laws in one country now, if this becomes fully accepted by our country, has some serious implications. You know, I'm an American. I post Nazi propaganda on a Yahoo chat board. It annoys someone in Paris. They call the FBI. I get arrested under French law in my place in Washington. That's a problem. Government problems, part two. Security is a very neat buzzword, but in reality, little is done. Why rock the boat? Things are proceeding along nicely. We have a couple of bumps now and then, but like politics and life, it'll even out. In the U.S. government, there are several stovepipe channels for dealing with computer security, critical infrastructure, information warfare, and they're all going up their separate chains of command, and there's very little coordination between them. So there's a lot of duplication of effort. Last year, remember the I guess it was this, about this time last year, we had the Amazon and the eBay attacks. It coincided with SANS, I think. Well, a week later, what's going to coincide with this conference? What hacks are going to occur?
Why are you looking at me?
Well, you picked me up at the airport. I figured you might know something.
I'm in a suit. I don't know anything.
That scares me. A hacker in a suit. No. Anyway, the week after these denial of service attacks occurred, what happened? What was the big news story the Tuesday after the event? There was a White House summit on cybercrime. Invited were several CEOs, Mudge from then at stake as the token quote unquote hacker, i.e., guy with the long hair. He's brilliant, but he's always toted as the token hacker. He's the only guy there who had long hair. A couple of cryptographers, and maybe one or two senior vice president muckety muck, from industry. And they met with the president for a couple of hours in the morning. Then they went outside and had a photo opportunity in front of the White House, which of course is par normal for Washington. And basically, what it equated to was a summit that went nowhere, and basically it gave the CEOs a chance to get some FaceTime with the president, get their picture taken with Mr. Clinton, and nothing came out. Why? I've argued this, I've continued to argue this, and I will forever continue to argue this, that CEOs and senior executives do not know security. They consider... Before you want to talk security about what to do, how it affects business, you need to address security before it becomes a business issue, which means you deal with it at the operational level. You want to address it, bring in your CIOs, bring in a couple of network administrators who actually have a clue about, what getting root actually is and does, not just, what they read about, in the newspaper, and address it at an operational level so that way it'll never become a business problem and it'll involve the CEO. If the CEO is involved in discussing hacker problems, you got problems. Yeah. That's the blind leading the blind leading the blind. It doesn't work. So basically, you want to talk security with the government. Stop having these CEO summits and bringing in all these striped suits folks. Bring in people that go to work wearing jeans. Yeah, they may wear a suit and tie for one day if they're meeting the president or the attorney general. But get people to actually have a clue about this stuff. And I don't mean just always bring the same set of people. Okay, Mudge is great. I've had some dialogues with him. I've heard him talk. The guy's rather brilliant. But, a lot of people think, well, he's just, the representative of the hacker community. Well, not really. You talk security for network solutions or, VeriSign. Bring in, the CIO. Bring in one or two people who actually, the senior folks who know security. Not just the CEO because, he's the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company. CEOs don't understand that kind of stuff. Another reason why security does not sell well in the U.S. government is the same reason why healthcare doesn't sell well for the military on Capitol Hill. What sells more votes? A new battleship or a new aircraft carrier that will generate 20,000 jobs over 10 years in a district, or $10 million for improved computer security, which really you can buy from ISS and no one's going to get any votes or benefits from it?
Prison.
Or prison. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, you got food, housing.
Yeah. The idea, basically, though, is security, computer security, IT security has never been a big item in the government because it doesn't sell votes. And since the votes mean people get elected and have job security on the Hill, they're going to do what's going to get them reelected, i.e. buy more bombers the Air Force says they don't need, you know, keep buying a plane helicopter that doesn't really work, keeps crashing. That's what they want to do because that's where the votes are. Computer security is not – it's funny. It's not high on the list of budget items, but golly gee whiz, it's high on the media hype items, isn't it? GAO reports and, you know, the cyber terrorists are out there. We got to deal with them. But when it comes down to putting money, there's very little money assigned to it. Moving on, military, information warfare. I mentioned Anthony Lake's little missive about if you're under 30, you're a cyber terrorist, or you can be a cyber terrorist. Well, gee, I got two more years before I'm safe. March 22nd of this year, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, again, a brilliant person, I might add, says cyber terrorism is a real problem. She's brilliant, but, you know, we all make mistakes. She says that, you know, it's a major problem, we got to deal with it, you know, it's a danger to national security. I have two responses to that. One is, people in, you know, her roles and those of the CEOs, attorney generals, people in the know in the government and industry don't understand the difference between nuisances from intentional hostile attacks. My website gets vandalized, whoop-dee-doo. I'll go to backup tape, restore, and assuming I have done good systems administration and good security and have competent staff, I'll be up and running in a short period of time. But that's different from a directed attack by a third party that actually is intended for malicious attacks, malicious intent. The focus is always on network attacks, okay? Network intrusion from overseas, you know, compromise. They call cyber terrorists the next big threat. Well, terrorists, from what I understand, and I'm an international relations major, and I've done, you know, some work in this field, terrorists want exposure. They want the media. Everybody see The Siege, Bruce Willis, you know, they took over New York. It was a very anti-Arab movie, anti-Islamic movie. Great line in there. Terrorist holds up in a room with 20 school kids, waiting to blow the place up. What's he waiting for? The news cameras. They want exposure. Cyber terrorists will get exposure, but it's nowhere near what you get by blowing up a power station, actually driving a truck bomb. Okay? I mean, you drive a truck bomb, you destroy the facility, the infrastructure. You don't just have another facility standing by you can wheel in and be up and running in 6 hours. You screw up a website, even a complicated one. 6 hours, you got backup tapes, you bring them back in, you know, wake up some systems admins, and you're back in business. Right? I mean, there's a huge difference. Very few people actually favor the electronic attack. You have a couple, the hacktivists, like the ELF, you know, and the Zapatistas. They enjoy this kind of stuff because, again, they don't have a lot of money, and this is the way they can get their point across and get some attention. And they've had some success doing it. But on the whole, cyber terrorism is a much overhyped problem. Cyber terrorism in today's age is the equivalent of the Red Scares, if you will, with the Soviet Union getting ready to launch missiles at us. I mean, I never had to do duck and cover drills in grade school, but I'm sure there are some of you in here who did, okay? Now it's like, you know, duck cover and, you know, reboot. Critical infrastructure protection, yet another moniker. Yeah. You have critical infrastructure protection. That's a major problem. You know, when these bad cyber terrorists and adversaries are going to go after our critical infrastructure and our assets.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. You're late. critical infrastructure protection, wonderful idea. But again, they're focusing on the network-centric focuses of it, that everything's all linked together with technology and the internet and networks. Well, if you want to protect your critical infrastructures that are riding on technology and networks, how do you do it best? Good information and physical security practices. You go back to the basics. And you make sure that you network only what you have to network. Why do we have to have power plants on the internet? I mean, granted, granted, there's some in this room that probably would want to enjoy, dude, I hacked Three Mile Island from Rubicon, dude, you know. But, you know, in reality, what is the point? What is the point of having? See, I knew he was going to do something. What is the point of having a power station or a water purification plant on the internet?
Pornography.
You would dial out for that. You wouldn't want to have it available unless you're well. You might, but I mean. If it was me, I would want to dial out, you know, for security. But the thing is that you have these organizations that have they're connecting everything, and it's, you know, you're just setting ourselves up for failure. You're building a castle on quicksand, and that's just the wrong way to go. Again, they've got it ass backwards. Like the PKI industry, they're doing it. The focus is on the wrong thing. Get back to the basics. good information security, good personnel reliability, good checks, and you'll do fine. Don't just, you know, compound the problem by creating more bureaucracy and inflating this threat to something that's, you know, you can't sleep at night. In fact, probably one of the most secure networks in the government is a standalone one. Yes, it is networked, Federal Reserve, significant bandwidth. They own it all. It's insulated. I mean, there's multiple layers of security. It's not something you just waltz into and hack, contrary to what Hollywood would say. Now, government part two, information warfare. Information warfare is seen by a lot of folks, from Hollywood to the Hill to the Pentagon, as being a silver bullet solution. A couple of years ago, when we were involved with Kosovo, the idea was we're going to use information warfare to go after Slobodan Milosevic's bank accounts in Switzerland. Okay, I'd give them about 30 seconds before the Swiss would be onto them. The Swiss had probably the best computer security around on their banks, with good reason. The folks we have doing information warfare in the Air Force and elsewhere, some of them are very good. Some of them have stepped on their collective anatomy several times with public embarrassment. Our folks have been involved with operations that, you know, they were caught snooping around the Australian Stock Exchange. Oops. We're not at war. Little side note here. Information warfare technology is not a silver bullet solution. Good example I give is a couple of years back, almost 10 years ago, I was at Fort Hood. We were doing a live fire exercise. And had a GPS thing on a laptop. It was part of the Army's big digitization, and, you know, bring all this technology stuff to the soldiers. And we were out there. I was a contractor, and I was working with my friend from the academy who's actually, you know, a soldier, artillery. He's doing forward observer. And his job was to call in the artillery, you know, to spot where the rounds would hit and then say, you know, move your stuff to the left or the right, or you're too far, or you're too low, or whatever. Well, he did it, and we were out in the field for 6 days, and it was kind of cool. I had to go back to the hotel. He actually had to sleep in a tent, and it rained. Day three of the exercise, it poured. It was miserable. There was mud. It was terrible. Well, in all the haste, the laptop fell off the back of the Humvee. It was armored, but it wasn't armored. The GPS, they had some, you know, the big GPS devices, and the batteries started going funky. And anybody who's been in the Army, who's seen the old radios from Vietnam, knows that, you know, those batteries, you know, you get them wet, they just get all funky, and they don't work, and they just become, you know, 10-pound bricks. Well, this was a live fire exercise, and the marching orders that this group was told was, you go out in the field, you are in actual combat, okay? This is the way it's going to be. You know, pretend you're overseas somewhere. My friend, being a great guy, said, okay, cool. So he had dropped the computer. He couldn't, you know, use the GPS stuff to do all this azimuths and that kind of stuff. So what did he do? Pulled out his hip pocket, and he had a little map, the grid map for the Army terrain, all nicely laid out, you know, with metrics and measurements. Got on the radio when it was their turn, and he did it the old-fashioned way with a compass, a protractor, the map, and the radio. And they called in the artillery rounds. Next day, they were back at the garrison, and they met with the contractor and the colonels to kind of figure out how this stuff worked in the field under combat conditions. And they were very impressed because my friend's forward observer, you know, he had 10 out of 14 rounds were in very close, almost on target, which considered an A minus average. And he said, "Well, gee, the technology worked really well, I guess. You know, would you recommend it?" And I just kind of bit my tongue because I wasn't the one talking. And my friend said, "Well, to be honest, sir, we didn't use it." He said it crapped out on day three when we had that rainstorm. I said, I called him in the old-fashioned way. And the contractor team and the colonels went ballistic. And that highlights a big a problem with where we're going with technology as a society. Amazon gets hacked, as an example. Bookseller auctions, you know, whatever else they sell, DVDs, they get hacked. My advice, I mean, I'm not the owner of Amazon, but still, I mean, it's a business. I mean, you can have a fire in a building just like you have a hack in a website. Amazon gets hacked. Big deal. Go to the corner bookstore, grab a latte, browse the shelves, and maybe even go out with a friend and reinvent the lost art of in-person socializing outside of sex. That's a new concept today. You know, we all point and click and buy our stuff online. Well, if we lose the ability to do stuff for ourselves, we become further enslaved to technology and the interests of big business. We become further dependent on the big businesses. That kind of ties back with the subscription ware and Windows XP and tying everybody to an identity and authenticating themselves. We become slaves on technology, and we forget how to do the basics. Anybody ever go to the store and experience what I call the computers are down syndrome? Doesn't that really piss you off when it's like 42 cents? You know, it's, you know, one of those big, round, shiny things, and, you know, two of these little, you know, and people are like, well, the computer's down, it won't tell me how to make change. That ain't public schools. Well, maybe it is, but that's common sense. That's something you learn from, you know, a family upbringing, you know, from life. You don't learn it from just on a computer. So, you know, my advice, big deal. As long as I can, you know, buy stuff at the grocery store, as long as I can go outside, you know, set up, walk to where I have to go, or, you know, buy a book, you know, what I can do it. I'm not worried about, you know, Amazon going down. If I'm the CEO of Amazon, I'm concerned, but assuming, keyword, that I have good backups, good processes and practices, if there's a problem, I'll be back in business in a couple of hours or maybe a day. Losses, yes, but they're mitigated compared to, you know, what it could have been. Wrapping up, going into personal technology and privacy. Well, my question is, we talk about, you know, MPAA and the RIA and, you know, the song and the artists have their rights and the writers have their rights. So what about my rights? What about my intellectual property? We have to register everything everywhere. We become slaves to the central commercialized big brother. I mean, 95%, a report came out last week, 95% of web folks do not disable cookies. 95%. I mean, they're fun to munch on while you're surfing, but I mean, you want to disable them, you know, for personal reasons. People decide to go to grocery stores and shoppers clubs. You register all your information, you know, name, address, income, family, all this other great stuff to get bonuses. Well, it's funny. My local grocery store in D.C., they started using little bonus cards. You swipe it and you get like, you know, X percent off. Coincided at the same time, they raised their prices 25% on everything. Okay. Hit me like a brick when I tried walking out with 4 pounds of salmon and it was like, you know, $30. I was like, what is this? Then the next week, same thing, it was like, you know, 12. What did I do? I registered for their bonus card. I used the name Dwight Eisenhower. Registered at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Southeast, Suite 412, Washington, D.C., 20036-2511. They took my application. Here's your card, sir. Have a nice day. That was 2 months ago. You take advantage of privacy where you can get it, okay? I mean, hopefully you've got Hotmail disposable accounts so you can do stuff. You know, you don't register software through your own personal account. You want to cut down on spam and bullshit? Get a Hotmail account or a Yahoo account. Register your software. Yeah, no, no, no. Yes. But you do it from a third party somewhere so that, you know, you get your commercial junk sent over there and you keep your personal stuff clean. This conference I was in France last week, they were talking about how soon you're going to be able to walk down the street with a cell phone and get targeted SMS messages and advertisements on your phone.
Spam.
GPS in the back of a taxi cab. You drive in front of a Starbucks, you see a little thing pop up. Hey, Starbucks, 20% off for new tourists, not New York City, whatever. Seriously, that's in the works. I got enough people calling me on my phone as it is. I don't need to have this kind of junk there. More we go, the more places we register and, you know, subscribe to, we leave a larger and larger trail for the marketeers and data miners to come in and start doing stuff. The noose is tightening around us. It's a very tangled web, and the noose is coming around each of us. We're all called a leash. A noose means you're going to die. A leash means you're going to get yanked and pulled, which we're being yanked and pulled by the big businesses. Look at TiVo and the video recorders. All of a sudden, oh, yeah, by the way, we are indeed monitoring what you watch. To a certain extent. Oh, yes, your name and your privacy information is being withheld, but we know what you're watching and when you're watching it and where you live. Well, personally, I don't. If I want to participate in demographics, I'll call Nielsen and say, send me a box. I want to be one of your reviewers. Don't assume I want to play. So what I want to leave you with in the personal technology section is, can't we just turn this off? Can't we just say, look, I've had enough. I don't want advertisements. I don't want marketing. Just leave me alone to live my life. I wish. Cliff Stahl, great author of The Cuckoo's Egg, a little goofy, but brilliant. I hated it. When MSNBC first came out, I used to watch The Site. It was on at 10 o'clock during the week. Hated the show, but I watched it for the last 5 minutes to catch Cliff's commentary. And Cliff's all over. He'd be up and down the stage, and, you know, he's all animated. And I think he's Italian. He talks with his hands. Well, I've become, he did a book last year called Confessions of a Computer Contrarian. Very good book. It's an easy read. And basically, you know, it talks about technology and where we're going. You know, this presentation has kind of followed some of that. Well, in a little homage to Cliff, one of the guys who got me involved in computer security way back when, just because we can doesn't necessarily mean we should. Okay? Do I really want to have an MP3 player on my cell phone? 32 megabytes MP3s. What is that, 6 songs, 5 songs? If I'm walking across, you know, across town, that'll get me, what, about a mile maybe? Big deal, you know? That's totally opposite from what a cell phone does. My cell phone is a communications device. Don't pack the technology in just because you can. Will it sell? Is it useful? I'm a firm believer the internet is not made for marketing. Okay? The power company doesn't always sell you a lot of marketing stuff in your bills. At least I don't get a lot of bills, marketing stuff. Okay? But now we're seeing larger banner ads. We're seeing skyscraper ones, flash ads in the middle of, you read CNET, and all of a sudden there's like this big animated brouhaha in the middle of the page. It's crazy. We're getting much more advertiser driven because the bucks aren't there. People are realizing that now there's no money to be made, we got to move elsewhere. And who's hurting? We've become hooked on this technology, and now, like a heroin addict, the cost is going up. And the cost is either in paying money for subscriptions that you pay for no ads, or too much ads and click-throughs that interfere with your web experience. I'm happy to pay for services. That's me. So if I could do that, I would. Do we need a central logon like .NET or Passport? I say no. I want my own identity. I want to take charge of my own identity. I want to verify to you all who I am. I will be my own certificate authority. I'll use my PGP keys. I will sign it. I will certify I'm who I am. If that key is compromised, I will replace it myself. I don't need to trust somebody to do it. I mean, I would trust the government, my driver's license, my passport, but that's the government. They're elected. Microsoft ain't elected. What about those without big network access? Windows XP is going to require software updates. They're going to happen behind the scenes without you even knowing it unless you see your router lights blinking. What if you're in the cornfields in Montana? How are you going to be able to do an update? You're a part of the digital have-not. You don't have DSL. You might have a 56K modem. A good one. What then? Some processes and products we can do to hopefully alleviate some of these problems I brought up. Open source it. Linux. Apple OS X. All right, alternatives. Don't just follow the leader. Don't just blindly jump after the most popular thing because everyone's doing it. I mean, if John jumps off the bridge, I'm not going to follow him because he's my friend and it's cool. I mean, if I want to, I will. Open source models and full disclosure for security. Open PGP, Open SSH, stuff that's out there and free, that's great. You can get inside the code and look at it. Unlike some other commercial operating systems and software that are big, large, and bloated and buggy, if you don't like something in Linux, you can go in and hack the kernel, hack the application, and figure it out, and move on. You have a very tight Linux box, a very tight Apple box. You can't have a very tight Windows box. You can't get in the code to take out what you don't want. Why load stuff you don't need and why is there no easy way to remove it? With regards to information security in the U.S. government, the military, the information warfare piece, you want to foster better communications with the industry and this public-private partnership, don't classify things. I have a security clearance. That's fine. That doesn't mean that I know anything more than what you know. Honestly, I probably don't. However, that doesn't mean I need to have the attitude that, well, everything's got to be top secret. All right. You want to talk to industry and share information? Don't say, we'll talk to you only if your entire staff gets accredited with a clearance. No. Very little stuff needs to be classified. And what classifying stuff does only means that you have to classify more things. Okay? It's a self-licking, self-generating ice cream cone. You dumb it down to the lowest possible denominator, and you classify only and guard only that most critical stuff. And the rest of it, you open up. You may sanitize stuff. I mean, saying that a denial of service attack is happening, that's not classified. And, saying that it's happening to the financial system is not classified. Saying it's happening to the financial system using Stockledger Act or TFN is not classified. Saying that it happened to the financial system using TFN, Stockledger Act, and happens to MasterCard, Visa, and Bank of America, that's sensitive. So you simply say some of the major companies. You may you may change the IP addresses, you may not. You don't need to classify everything. I mean, the fewer secrets, the better it is for us security folks. Open communications will further foster private and public partnership discussions. Be less arrogant on the government side. Private sector side will be much more receptive to talking and dealing with you. Corporate interests seem to be governing security and reliability. Remember complacency. We'll fix it when we want to, when we get around to it, not when it's appropriate. It took 2 years for Network Solutions to close the domain hijacking hole. When AOL was hijacked in October of 98, it took about a week for me to go through the report with my staff, write it, figure out exactly what happened in the process and where to fix it and develop some countermeasures for it. Like 20, 30 lines of code, a couple little business process changes. The response I got back from the management was, well, it'll annoy our partners, it'll make it too difficult for the end users, and we really shouldn't deal with it just yet. Meanwhile, 6 months later, we're still getting 500 more hijackings, 600 big companies, lots of bad press. And the company figured that it was better to have the negative press and develop new business products. Finally, 2 years later, they actually closed the vulnerability, but by that time, it was like, that was like, buffer overflow in Windows. It's like, oh, well, it happened, it's another one. Oh, another hijacking. And I get calls for it. I said, forget it. Talk to the call center. I mean, it became passe. So you have to be aware of corporate interests governing how security is addressed in terms of reporting and in rectifying vulnerabilities. So the real threats and vulnerabilities with living in a technology world, lest we become techno-slaves. Be careful that we're not litigating as opposed to innovating. You can't stop movements. I mean, the Hollywood industry is fearful because for once in their lives, technology is not in their hands but in the hands of the little people. We decide what we want to watch, how we want to watch it, not what Hollywood dictates we do and when we do it. That has Hollywood terrified. Okay? If you want a particular song off of one particular group, take a Metallica or Def Leppard, pick a group. You like one song. You want to get every single version of that song you can, live, wherever. Why do you have to spend, $500 on imports to find it when, you get online Napster and you can pick just the songs you want and download it? I wouldn't mind being able to pay, a couple of bucks to get that service. That's a great service. But I want to be in control of what I watch. I'm sick of having the industry saying, here are 9 songs on this CD we're going to pay you charge 17 bucks for, of which I only like 2 songs. That's wrong. Let me make my own mix. Innovation's a movement. You can't really stop a movement. It's an idea. You might be able to quash the technology or, the single voice, but the movement continues. Beware of sole sourcing on closed, buggy operating systems and software. Beware of subscriptionware and control over your data and your cyber livelihood in the internet age. Beware and take charge of your identity and your individual privacy, both real and anonymous. If you want to be anonymous, you should be anonymous. If you want to be real, you should be real. But you should have that choice. If you want to go shopping somewhere and buy an airline ticket as a guest, you should have that right. That guest account may be authenticated that, yes, it is indeed who you say you are, but it's an anonymous middle identity. That's great. But you should have that choice. Stop being arrogant. Learn to listen. This is directed towards some of the federal folks. Congress is coming online. They're getting a clue. I applaud them. I applaud the Senate, Orrin Hatch, Pat Leahy. There are more Congress folks getting a clue about this stuff, and that's great. It's going to help us out in the long run. To big business, I implore you to stop force-feeding us the next best thing simply because you can. Think instead, should we? Do we really need it? I have WAP on my phone. I've never used it. The microbrowser is the biggest piece of junk I've ever seen. Why do I need that? I mean, it's cool. Okay, fine. I tried it. If I couldn't send an email in 2 minutes by going punch, 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 next, punch, punch, next, punch, oh, back up. It's pointless to me. I don't want to deal with that. To the White House, to Congress, to the military, to law enforcement, to business, I say stop giving us knee-jerk reactions. Take real action. Involve the real players, not just the people interested in photo op or campaign money. In conclusion, accept technology when it's relevant and useful. Don't just blindly jump on board. And when I started off, I said that the Matrix is here. Well, as we've gone through the past hour and a half, I hope you've kind of seen that it is. Because the way the people outside this room, we have a clue. And if you picture us as the 50 or 100 of us as little individual Neos and Morpheuses, we see the big picture. We understand, we have this perception of what's really going on outside of that little bubble, the little cocoon that was powering the aliens. We understand that. And we're that small group that's trying to rise out and actually make a difference in how society is going down this path of internet technology and technological innovation. So we're leaders in this field. Contrary to what people say, what the media says, we are leaders. The Matrix is here. See another example of Hollywood predicting reality. I'm kind of glad to be part of this because it's kind of cool. And I'm going to close with the saying from my old Army drill sergeant, you stay alert in changing times, and you'll stay alive in changing times and for the future. With that, I thank you for your time, your attention. It's been fun. I'm glad to be here and hope to talk to you all during the weekend. Thank you very much. But don't get up just yet. All right, where's Jim?
He's
Yo, little man. Jim.
What are you in for?
Get him. Okay. Meantime, told you I was going to do some giveaways. Well, we have time for some questions. We want to do a couple of giveaways first. Questions can drag out in front of the bar. I've earned it. I have two copies of my book, The Art of Information Warfare, up for raffle or auction. The way it's going to go is I'm going to give it to the oldest person and the youngest person in the room who is not speakers or conference staff. So, who here was born after 1990? Good. 88. 86. 84. 1984. There are no 16-year-olds here, 15-year-olds. Who here was born in 1984? 85. 86. 85. Stand up. Come on up.
All right.
Just hang out there for a second. Just hang out for a quick second. Okay. Yes, you're on center stage. They're all looking at you. All right. Who here was born prior to, 1970? 1960? 1950? 1940? 45. You were born in 45? 40. Come on up, sir. Come on up. And you got a bet? Yeah, okay, come on up. And Jim, come on up here. Otherwise, I'll probably never see him for the rest of the weekend because he's running around like a chicken with his head cut off. So this one copy's going to Jim. He's putting on a great conference so far. I appreciate the invite. Hopefully you all got something out of this. Hopefully he got something out of it. I don't know. But anyway, Jim, this is for you. Thanks for the invite. It's been fun.
Thanks for coming.
And I've got a 21:45. We have like 15 minutes for questions or discussion if you want to open it up. I mean, if that's all right.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Anybody got any thoughts, comments, criticisms? Comment in the Blondie.
I have
about a month ago, I think, Slashdot reported that the FBI had taken the new stance of releasing information about a Windows attack that was currently ongoing. They basically said, we need your help, here's what we know, and published it widely.
Yeah, the question was the FBI recently, they actually reported on a Windows vulnerability and actually solicited help from the industry. And, you know, what do I think about it? It's a start. The problem is, and I've said this from day one, the computer crime stuff that's happening in NIPSI does not belong sitting in the FBI. And, yeah, they got some good feedback from the industry. I think they would have much more feedback, much more proactive feedback across the board if NIPSI was plucked out of the FBI into a third party somewhere else, that industry didn't have the perception that they were talking to, you know, the G-man all the time. So it's a start. Yeah, it's a positive step. But, again, it's a step. There's much more to come.
What do you think of the private commercial internet security companies? I have a friend who runs DaVinci.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think of them in general?
For the most part, they're pretty good. Some of them have done very well for themselves. They've come up in the past couple of years. They made some good money. Others are not so good. The internet security, some of the internet companies that are out there are very sensational and will release advisories or press releases more to generate business and panic and hype than to really make a difference and help the community. Some of them will centralize the cyber terror threat. Oh my God, this is the next best thing. There's a huge cyber war somewhere, and we got to deal with it. Might get over it. Come down to reality. Make a difference for the community, not just your bottom line. Some of them are very good. I have no problem with that. I work with some of them.
What are your views on security through obscurity?
On what?
Security through obscurity.
I do not subscribe to that at all. Security through obscurity does not work. It may work inside a company when you want to see something by the boss, but security through obscurity, there are people in this room that, we'll see right through that. Sir?
What about IPv6? Will that have any effect on
security? It will when it gets fully rolled out and people actually unlearn what they've already learned. It's kind of like, Yoda telling Luke Skywalker, unlearn what you've already learned. There is no good or bad. There just is. IPv6 isn't really a new way of looking at the internet, and people are going to have to, the techies are going to have to go back and look at the basics and then figure out, again, how do we go from here? Where do we go? It'll help. I admit I'm not totally up to speed on IPv6, but it's an improvement. It's part of the total security package that we can deal with. That's just not, it's not a fire and forget solution. It'll definitely help.
Going back to some of your IP points that you made, mm-hmm. I agree with most of them, but just to play a little devil's advocate, one of the more popular arguments in the RIA and NPAA recently has been that 15 years ago, piracy was some guy in a theater with a camera selling these tapes on the street, same thing with cassettes. Mm-hmm. But now you essentially have these perfect copies.
Mm-hmm.
What's your counter argument to that?
My comment on that is actually I kind of glossed over that at the beginning, and I kind of ran through it at the end, and that is, the question was, piracy now is so much easier to do with perfect copies on the net. That's what, the RIA and the MPA is claiming is a problem. Piracy, one person can, give to millions, but I don't think that's really the issue at hand. The fundamental issue is that, the industry is not in control of the content. And they're scared of losing control of the content. That's why they're pushing for copy protection controls and whatnot under the guise of pirating as a way to kind of, pirating sounds really evil and nasty. And if they can spin it up in that negative approach, then it sounds better for the public and for the Hill. I think that the bigger problem is that, Napster basically enabled people to, get what they wanted. Was it stealing? Yes. Was it wrong? Yes, in the legal sense. No, in the, the music aficionado sense. It was kind of, I should be able to find what I want without having to go through layers of bureaucracy or copy protection. That kind of answer your question a little bit?
Well, I think their argument is more that there's previously there was a cognitive dissonance. The tape was a little scratchy. You can kind of tell it was a bootleg. But now, it's really, you can't tell.
Well, I have, personally, and, I'm being recorded, so what the heck. I don't have a problem with, somebody getting what they want, sharing a song among friends, okay? I've got 3 gigs MP3s on my laptop, okay? You want something, I'm happy to share them with you. I'm not going to sell it to you. I didn't create it, okay? But, I enjoy the music, you enjoy the music, that's fine. Now, if I was selling, these things, have a website and charging through PayPal, yeah, that's wrong because I didn't create that stuff. And that goes into the whole thing with fair use and, being able to copy stuff from my brother at home is legal right now. I can do that off of the CD. But if these other copy controls come online, I can't even do that. Fair use is a very sticky issue right now in the IP circles. Even like the video recorders, like the TiVos and whatnot, you can record a program in your living room, and if what is anticipated happens, you cannot pop that out and bring it upstairs, your TV upstairs, and watch it up in your room. Or do it on a digital videotape, I should say. The tape is tied to that particular device. That's a problem. I'm in my own house. If I want to watch it laying down in bed as opposed to being in the couch, I should be able to do that. So, back.
What's your feelings on the movement towards managed security outsourcing, counterpane AI, and movements within casualty prevention insurance companies and hacking insurance?
Do you work for counterpane or any of those managed security groups? Okay. No, really? managed security is a group in its infancy. If you start a business solely on doing basically becoming the AZT burglar alarm company of the internet, I don't think you're going to survive. people aren't going to pay 10 or 20 grand a month just for you to monitor the firewall saying up, down, hack, no hack. I mean, you know, a monkey could do that. Where there is money is in companies that do this, that do traditional computer security consulting, and then include that as part of their suite of offering that can round out their products. Excuse me? Yeah, and you look at other companies like the Riptex, the Paraprotex, that are actually doing rather well. But again, they're not based solely on managed security. It's one of their offerings. Riptex and Paraprotex and one or two of the others, they start out doing security consulting, security engineering, policy development, that kind of stuff. And then, it's kind of interesting. Let's make that as an additional offering. That's how you make the money. And you start off doing stand up a SOC and monitor people. You're probably sink, rather quickly. On the second point about casualty insurance, hey, it's your money. I mean, you want to take out an insurance policy on your website, go right ahead. I mean, so be it.
As long as Bruce's name came up, let me segue into the other thing he likes to tag to that a lot, which is that you said that it is an issue for security people, not CEOs. And CEOs should not be involved. I'm not saying exactly what you did. But Bruce had kind of an epiphany where he woke up realizing he'd spent his whole life trying to harden cryptography, and all he was doing was strengthening the door, and there were all these windows. Mm-hmm. And he got into this new business seeing that computer security is not just about computer security, but there really is a much broader context to which it operates, and that's risk management.
Yes,
And that's coming to the fore of a lot of people's thinking, so it's mm-hmm. true that security guys are the only ones who really know about security. But the decision is often made by other people, and I'm just asking if you think that's appropriately so,
yes.
about how much security to have in the larger context of what is the risk here, what is it worth if we go down, if we lose I had somebody quote to me $600 million mm-hmm. we can take because we do so much business that we can absorb that kind of strike. It's not worth it to us to harden the site. Right. Not the site, but our whole system.
I do actually. The question was basically, is computer security part of a larger, risk management picture for companies as far as doing cost effectiveness? And you're absolutely right. I do another series of lectures for companies on basically risk management and say, look, computer security is part of it, but, you look at computers as basically the tools. I call it information security more and more because there are other processes involved than just, the physical computers. If you talk to a CEO, as a former, chief security officer, I had CEO, line of communication. And if I went into him and say, look, I want to do X, Y, and Z because it's good security, I might get X. But if I went and said, look, if you look at, X, Y, and Z and apply it in the context of, this will enable you to do this and this and this for the products, and you place security in the context as an enabler, something that can help grow profits and guarantee profits, you have a much better chance of getting it pushed through. So, yeah, definitely security is... It's a question of semantics, in my opinion, because I look at security from that very perspective. Yeah. Other questions? Two more, and we're done. Back there.
Concerning the CSS, mm-hmm. Some people argue that code is free speech, or it's speech protected by law. What are your thoughts on that? What do you think of possibly having code of yours censored? Yeah.
Question was basically, is DCSS is considered free speech by some and freedom of expression? What do I think about it? Great website is Dr. David Cheratsky, I can't pronounce his name, up at Carnegie Mellon. He's got a great website. It's the DCSS gallery. And it's DCSS done in several ways, from an Adobe PDF file, thanks to me, to JPEG pictures of the code, to a romantic musing where the code is read line by line in MP3. By something sick, twisted individual. it's a gray area. I don't agree that code is free speech necessarily, but I do have a problem with people trying to clamp down every single mode of expression. That's why DCSS got so much exposure in the first place, because the MPA has told 2600, look, you can't post links to it. They said, okay, fine. They just remove the links. 2-second fix, upload the file, and you're back in business. Oh, well, you can't put the links on the web page. Okay, fine. Took them down, set up an IRC. Hey, go to http://www, whatever. Response. Yeah, come over here to www. And that was considered dialogue online. So now are they going to censor dialogue that was discussing this? And there's all these what-ifs that you can cascade. You tell me don't do it this way, fine, I'll do it this way. You tell me don't use Napster, I'll use Nutella. I'll use FTP. Whatever. I mean, code, I don't think code in itself is free speech. That's just my opinion. I mean, take it for what it's worth. One more question, last question. Sir.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier you were going to make a comment on free PGP versus commercial.
Yeah, free PGP. By the way, if you're going to use free PGP or PGP, stick with versions 6.58. Don't go into the 7s. I don't trust anything that came out from Network Associates in the past year. Phil Zimmerman, the guy who invented PGP, just left Network Associates, citing differences. There's a lot of uncertainty. A lot of folks are not trusting NAI's version of commercial PGP. So stick with the freeware stuff. Go to pgpi.com, download the international stuff, and use that. The free stuff, you actually can see the source code and look at it. Okay, NAI stuff's precompiled, and they say that it's the same source code as out there. Again, it's business. Who are you going to trust? Any other questions? I will be at the bar. Feel free to come join. Thanks for the attention, the fun, and have a great conference.